Yeah, we welcome the AFL CEO, Gil McLachlan. Hi, Gil. How are you going? We're just discussing... good morning to you, sir. We're just discussing Mitch Clark and Brian Lake and joining on the back of this. And David King posed the question, which is worse? If there is a false allegation, we're not saying there is, but that has been bandied around, which is worse? Labelling somebody that they are vilifying somebody with a mental illness, or I don't know what's the correct terminology, as opposed to actually...
Mental health, yeah.
Or the actual on-ground slur.
I don't think either are ideal.
No.
I think I just heard you, as I walked in, you said messy, Rob. I think it's just messy. I think ultimately, you know, in issues like this, whether it's broader vilification or this specific alleged vilification, it's about the player who's you know, allegedly been impugned. And in this case, Mitch clearly just wants to move on. So whether is that what actually happened, there's confusion about that. And where it should go under either scenario, what's clear is he wants to move on and think about the footy this week. And
so why does he bring it up? Do you broach that with him and say, you can tarnish somebody's reputation if you want to move on?
Yeah,
why bring it up?
I don't. Mark Evans has been dealing, and I don't know the specific ins and outs. I just know there's confusion about even how the allegation was raised.
It might be an AFL Players Association issue, I think, dealing with players.
Yeah. Is it a reportable offence?
In terms of actually,
if you've vilified, no. Would this be if this happened again? Would this be considered a reportable offence?
Yeah, yes, it is. I looked around, Patrick. I think it can be, but broadly, the policy is actually mediation and actually settling the issue between the players. If it's serious enough, it can be.
You've been kissed on the head the start of the season.
Gee, that came out a lot better than I thought it was going to.
That's why I said head. That's why I said head. We've had a really traumatic 2 years, the game has. The game itself has started really well, but now the game has been hurt by the discussion and the realisation, the realism that two players have tested positive. That's four in the last 12 months, which four's four too many, Gil. So the game, the matches are going great. The fans are back and the fans are happy. But suddenly we've got this new scourge called performance-enhancing drugs. And allegedly the discussions about illicit drugs being used in conjunction with, unknowingly by players, performance-enhancing drugs. Is it a major issue or is this just... A bad month.
Well, it's you know, potentially a bit of both. The opening round last weekend was amazing. The footy was incredible, and the crowds and the ratings, and it was just felt good last weekend. And you know, everyone's like, I mean, I'm excited about the game today. Richmond, the Bulldogs are they're like the Harlem Globetrotters. There's a lot of good stories last weekend. But this issue is around. Our job at the AFL is to work with the clubs and the players and get the policy settings right and deal with the issue. Now, part of it all that, Robbo, is that, you know, what the issue is not clear in some of the circumstances. It's not clear what's happened at Collingwood, and there's a lot of different theories in the background and stories. All I know is that if there's four instances or incidents in the last couple of years in various forms, and there's other bits of stuff lying around, the policy settings need looking at, and that's what Andrew Dillon and Mark Evans will lead, is a review of all of our policy settings with the players, with the clubs, with all the relevant parties, and hopefully get a set of settings that actually can make sure that we move forward and don't have these things going forward.
I don't want to get weighed down with that, because I think it's pretty much a given there's going to be changes, so there's no point asking new questions and getting new quotes in the paper saying there's going to be changes. How close did the Carmichael Hunt situation, or is it close, or is it really directly involving the Gold Coast Suns?
Well, all I know is that I don't have any information. So that might mean it's a million miles. It might have got close. All I know...
You'd know by now, wouldn't you? You'd think?
Well, I don't know what I don't know, Robert. All I can tell you here is that I have no information that pertains to anything related to Carmichael Hunt and the Gold Coast Suns. So... I can only answer that.
So that issue's dead for you in the AFL until...
Listen, this area, this last 2 years has taught me anything. It's not to be overconfident about this broader thematic. But, you know, all we can do is try and do the best we can about education, about policies, about settings and about our system, and deal with things as they come up on a case-by-case basis. So I don't have any information around the Suns, but, you know, we can only just try and go forward on that basis. If something happens, it'll happen.
Gil, can I ask you on the drug front? The clubs, a number of people from clubs have been pushing for a harder line. That's one thing, but they've also been pushing for more of a direct involvement themselves. Is that a possibility that the clubs could get as far as actually being in charge of some sort of testing when we're talking about illicit drugs?
That'll be worked through. I don't want to get to the conclusions. What I would say is that, you know, this is a voluntary program brought in 10 years ago by the players, and something that's 10 years old obviously needs to be reviewed, and times change, and I think society's changed a lot in the last 10 years. But our players were years ahead of any other sports league in the world in submitting themselves to this testing. And I think during this journey, their views may well have changed. And I think the maturity and the ability of clubs to deal with these issues has evolved a hell of a lot in 10 years. So I think the attitudes and the understanding of these the challenges, whether they're the health and well-being or the other challenges more broadly, I think the clubs are in a better place now than they were.
That sounds like that's a chance of happening then.
I don't know what will happen. The guys will work through a process, but I do know that the clubs are much better position they were to play a greater role.
Gil, can I ask you, how does the AFL yourself know that equalisation is working? What are the checks and measures in place, apart from the ladder, which really hasn't changed position greatly over the last 4 or 5 years?
Well, equalisation's got two aspects. It's like the on-field, the football part. And
let's talk about the on-field.
The on-field. Yeah. The theory of equalisation is that everyone's got a 1 in 18 chance and ultimately you'll get your turn over the period of time.
Is that right, though? Is that happening?
Well, there's been a level of evidence, whether it's definitive enough, that in the last few years that actually the natural evolution has not actually occurred in the same way it did the year before. I think in the 10 years... From 1999 to 2009, 15 of 16 clubs, potentially all 16 clubs, played in a preliminary final. What we've certainly seen in the last 6 years, and I'll be taking task on that, but I think it's pretty much everyone did. In the last 5 or 6 years, we've certainly seen an ability for clubs to maintain themselves at the top
level.
Well, you've
got two teams won 6 of the last 8 premierships.
That's a critical part of it, though, because free agency now has come in and is part of that 6 years you're talking about.
We had during that period, though, Dan, we had clubs had sustained success, whether it was Brisbane or Port Adelaide during that period, but all the teams essentially through that period had a crack at a preliminary final, didn't quite get there. But our preliminary finals have been pretty consistent. Now, I don't think, have enough definitive data to say that the ability to spend on non-players in the footy department is definitively the reason that's happened, but there's enough to say there's a fair chance. So there's a linkage now between the on-field equalisation, the footy equalisation, and the off-field equalisation, because what we have to do is make sure that we have the right people, all in the right slots at these lesser clubs, the ability to pay 100% of the salary cap, and the ability to spend a competitive amount on non-player footy department spend. And that's what we're working through at the moment, is to get themselves in the position to be able to do that.
So the team, the thing I find is tough to swallow. The wrong teams are spending way, way much more time down the bottom, finding it harder to get out of the bottom four than those top teams are spending at the top. They're up the top a lot longer than these teams down the bottom. The draft, to me, because you're fraught with danger, you actually really have to get it right. And if you can't get it right, you only have to get it half wrong, and you're still down there for another half year at the minimum. Is the draft enough compensation in its current format for the teams that are, and I hate using the word, because you do say, you make a great point, in the last 16 years, everyone just about has played a preliminary final. They are cellar dwellers. And they are there as long as our asses point to the ground.
Well, the one thing is definitively, everyone agrees with you, I think, Derm, is it takes a long time.
Too long.
Historically, you've got the rewards. If you look at, even Hawthorne's, you know, built this off Franklin, Roughhead, Lewis, Hodge, you know, the period. They've all done it. St Kilda's, you know, they didn't win a grand final, but they were built off a number of drafts. But God, it takes a long time, David. Now, our guys are looking at whether we can do something quicker. It was interesting the other day, you know, I think I can talk to this because, you know, confidential. I mean, we had, the commission had lunch with all of the club coaches. And it was a pretty consistent theme that actually, you know, it takes a couple of years to reprogram these talented kids we're seeing playing out here at the moment.
Ruzzi spoke about this week on 360, and he was hoping about the reintroduction of under-19s.
Yeah, so I think there seems to be a bit of an industry push that maybe the draft age could be looked at. There's problems with it. This is, you know, the guys will look at this to say, so when you get the number one pick or the number two pick, there may be a couple of years further developed and they're more ready to have an immediate impact. That, you know, the sort of feeling is that the style of game being played now, these guys, these incredible talented kids coming out, but then they've got to learn a whole new set of skills when they get to a club.
But Gil, the gap...
Even the ability to just have the right technique to lift weights, apparently.
The gap between the team that wins the flag and the gap between the team that wins the spoon is one player. It's pick one. Because they alternate picks after that, 18 and 19, 36 and 37. The gap is one player. It's just not enough. On a list of
40. And if you have a kid who's going to go number three, who they pick up,
and what if he's a
for their number 19? That's going to really impact them.
I think it's a real issue, and I don't have the answers. But what we have to do, I mean, this game is all about hope and the chances of winning more games than not, and hopefully winning a premiership. And if it's you know, there is a big lead time now between, you know, bottoming out and your chance, and if we can, if there are opportunities to accelerate that, we'll explore them.
I know you've got to go, Gil.
Hello, I just have to say this. It's like buying in real estate in this town. The finances of this industry have changed so much that the young kid coming in, he will stay there, and the teams with the finances who can go out there and get him whatever way they can afford him. The lower ranked teams can't afford the finances to keep these super talented kids. The world's changed. They just can't hang on. You're scratching your head at me. But they can't hang on to that kid. He's leaving. He's going for culture as well.
Yeah, but I don't see the evidence of that part, Dem. I know people think that intuitively. Last year, the Ryder left one of the biggest clubs in town, Essendon. Beams left the biggest...
That was an extraordinary case, though.
Beams left Collingwood and went to Brisbane. And Christensen left Geelong and went to Brisbane. And Ryan Griffin went to the Bulldogs, but to GWS. The three destination clubs were two at Brisbane, one at GWS, one at Port Adelaide. 2 years ago, they were all cellar dwellers, not destination clubs. They only left big clubs. And last year, 55 guys eligible for free agency. Five left, 50 stayed. And if only the only guy that left was James Frawley. And the context, for big money and a younger age. And he only three clubs that bid for him were the guys competing for a premiership, as I understand it, Hawthorn, Geelong and Fremantle. So all I'm questioning is, I don't have the answers, but I'm not seeing the evidence of free agency and that cultural issue yet. I'm not saying you're not right. I just don't see it. I do agree with you totally, though. The time to turn the ship around using the draft system is a challenge. And, you know,
will you look at more drafts for the lower?
Damn.
I know, but we don't get him often.
Your real estate story soaked up to him.
As we let you go, Gil, timeline for the interchange cap. When do we know that?
Another one, Hutto.
I know. All I know is it'll be in time for sort of in the second half of the season, so the clubs have got time to prepare.
All right. Thank you, Gil.
Righto, guys.